Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 315 of Roguecast, recorded December 2nd, 2020. A mind hopper.
Once again, we are recording on a Wednesday, which is a little bit weird, because usually we record on Tuesday, but our comics came in late, and everything is crazy because of crazy holidays and COVID times.
Not late for you guys. Late for us.
Yeah, for you guys it was completely invisible, hopefully.
I'm very tired.
And filled with many, many cool books this week.
And also, with us this week, Anna is here to talk about Future State.
Hi.
She killed Dave.
I can't see you waving.
No, I am Dave.
Oh, okay. I thought you killed Dave and we were going to have to resurrect him using the protocols again.
I am become Dave, destroyer of management.
This is how I knew you were tired. You were waving at the podcast listeners.
I also literally said I'm tired.
Yes.
So,
but waving
that was
is
my
bigger.
Second clue.
But it happened first.
Nope.
Okay, that's fair.
Sherlock Holmes style. I put it all together out of order. I built my mind palace.
You're like doing the yeah. geometric shapes
yes,
in the
yeah.
air and like all the calculations.
I built my mind palace and said, Anna just waved at the listeners. I wonder if she's tired. And then I flash back and there's this ghostly image of you saying, I'm tired. And I was like, yep, good job, your mind palace, we're all done.
It might have also been the two cups of coffee that I had this morning, so.
In fairness, that's not unusual for you.
You're right, that isn't unusual.
Randy's mind palace is slow.
Your mind?
It's true. My mind palace is more of a mind shack.
Yeah, I was going to say.
A mind hovel.
A mind hovel, yes. Yes. All right, so Future State. There's not a lot of news this week, so we are actually going to talk... I guess before we talk about Future Star, I should real quick talk about store news.
Yeah.
Talk about the game stuff that came in. We got a restock on Parks, which is a game that we played about, like, I want to say, like, 2 years ago.
Oh, I love it.
It's actually put out, like, in conjunction with the Parks Association, the National Wildlife.
Parks, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's got art from all the national parks. Basically, it is a little game where you play hikers, and you're trying to hike national parks and take pictures, and get souvenirs or whatever it is. I don't remember. Painting, something like that.
That sounds really cool. It sounds kind of relaxing.
It was super fun.
It's extremely relaxing.
And it's really nice to have it in stock. It's good to have it back in. There's also a solo game called Under Falling Skies.
Yes.
Which is like a campaign play game that is from the guys who do Codenames. And it looks very space invaders.
I was going to say, if the back is any representation of what the game is like, it looks like Space Invaders, the board game.
Huh. We also got the newest Unmatched, which is the Buffy the Vampire Slut.
Yes.
Set.
I think you
combined Slayer and Set into one word. I was just gonna walk over it, just like whatever. Like,
wait a second, did you just say Buffy the Vampire Slut?
Buffy the Vampire Slut. That is it's a fanfic I'm working on in my mind.
Oh jeez.
I think it's gonna have a really wide audience.
I think that Joss Whedon might like it, so
you're probably right. So Buffy has... The Unmatched has been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Dave and I have played it. I'm trying to loop you guys into playing it at some point.
So this one has the main characters of Buffy.
So it's Buffy, Angel, Spike,
Willow.
And Willow.
Yeah.
And they each have their like sidekicks. So Buffy can have either Xander or Giles.
I thought that was cool.
Spike gets Drusilla. Angel gets Faith.
Yep.
And Willow gets Tara.
5x5, boss.
It's cool.
Love that.
These are fun little mini. They basically each comes with a detailed miniature, a deck of cards. The art is all done by Mondo, so it's really pretty. It's a super easy to play game, and you can mix and match. So if you ever want to see how Buffy the Vampire Slayer might match up against King Arthur.
Oh, you can do that?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's delightful.
Or if you wanted, say, Willow to fight a bunch of raptors.
versus Bigfoot.
Spike versus Bigfoot.
That actually, I could come up with a story. That works in my brain. And the King Arthur versus Buffy, she's fought Dracula.
Sure. Yeah.
Spike versus the Thing of Raptors is a little harder.
What about Muldoon and Injun versus Angel?
Actually, you said Willow versus Raptors, and she could have done something magic that opened a portal to the Jurassic period or
you can
make reasons.
The only thing I don't like about that one is that I have to choose between whether or not I every time play Willow or Spike.
Yeah.
Mean of them to make me have to choose.
To make
that.
It even better, I guess I heard that Willow could become Dark Willow.
Yeah, yes. That was what I heard. So
we also got the newest batch of D&D minis, which there's a couple neat things in there.
Yes.
One, there's the Froghemoth.
Yes,
which is delightful.
Which is great. They are doing Magic the Gathering minis.
Yep.
Yeah.
First time ever. Which has, like, who's Rakdos?
So Rakdos, the Lord of Riots, is the leader of the cult of Rakdos.
Is he a monster?
He's a big, giant demon who runs a circus full of bondage clans.
When I was putting it into the system yesterday, I was like, it's fun to be a Lord of Riot.
Right?
Yeah.
He's also known as Rakdos the Defiler, which is a lot less fun sounding. But, like, also, they have, like, really amazing Ravnica minis. Like, one of the Sphinxes from the Azorius Temple.
An angel?
Yeah, they have Aurelia, who is basically one of the angel bosses of the Boros Legion. And then they have Borborygmos, who is the worst Magic the Gathering card, but the coolest person. So
I will say, I don't know much about Magic. They are very cool minis, regardless. But I also think you can utilize them in D&D campaigns.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Whatever. They don't have to be who they are.
I mean, like, for whatever, like, Rakdos is just a big, ugly demon with a cool sword. So,
he's like a variant of a pit devil.
Yeah, he's almost literally just a pit devil.
There's also there's a Firbolg Druid.
Cool.
Not a lot of Firbolgs these days, so that's good to see.
There's an Ankheg.
There's Warforged Fighter.
Yeah.
1 million goblins.
Goblin rogues, goblin fighters, that's some fun stuff.
The cool thing is that those are player characters now.
Yeah.
You can rogue, fighter, and I think there's a female rogue as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, we got the tower. This is this massive...
It's huge.
...giant tower where you can open it up. There's a staircase inside. You can basically have, like, a running fight in there. It is one of the biggest sets of terrain we've seen.
Yeah.
It's a collaboration with their Warlock tiles. It works with the Warlock tiles that they've done.
Mm-hmm.
It is pricey, but if you're looking for a Christmas present either to put on your list or for someone you know who plays D&D... this would be, like, the most amazing thing you'd ever under the tree. Also...
If you want to make your DM the happiest person in the holidays, this is, like, the best gift to get.
If you want to guilt your DM for killing your character...
That too.
You'd be like, I bought you this tower, and then you murdered my character. And the DM, if I know DMs, and I do, will be like, yeah, that's too bad.
Thanks for the tower,
Thanks
nerd.
Thanks for the tower. Why don't you make another first-level character I can murder?
Could you imagine turning this into, like, if you have, like, your adventuring group and that's your base?
Yeah,
that'd be
cool.
Awesome,
that'd be
actually.
So cool.
Yeah. Anyway, also, you remember when you were a kid and, like, you would always want to open the biggest present first?
Yeah.
And inevitably, it was, like, not the coolest present you got, because size doesn't make the coolest. As Yoda taught us, size matters not.
That's true.
But you always want to open the big present. This would look awesome under the tree. It looks like a big flat-screen TV.
Yeah,
it's huge. Also, I'm pretty sure that at least 75% of us have tripped over it at this point.
Yes.
It's so large.
Yes. Super cool. Definitely worth a look. Okay. Let's talk Future State. This is DC's event that they're doing in January and February.
Basically, all their other books are kind of quietly coming to a close, and this is what is going to be published instead.
So there are 25 miniseries, all of which are somewhere between, like, a couple issues and, like, one-shots.
Yep.
There's a little booklet we've got that we're all looking at that basically is a little freebie book, so you can still get that. Mm-hmm. And we've actually got a fillable PDF on our Facebook that you could fill in if you want to order any of it. But this is basically, I guess, after DC Death Metal ends, there's, like, a big change in the multiverse kind of thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden there are... I can't tell how far in the future it is. It says 2040?
Yeah, there's like a little timeline, and it ranges.
Timeline.
It ranges between 2040 and the end of time.
So the Dark Detective one is like 2027, which is not super far. And then, yeah, it goes all the way to the end of time. Because I guess the Legion is in here, and they're in year 40, year 3000. But they're breaking into three groups. They're doing the Future State, the Justice League, Future State Batman, and Future State Superman.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that Superman also incorporates, like, Wonder Woman and maybe Aquaman.
I thought that was the Justice League.
That's Justice League.
Yeah.
And Batman has a bunch of other characters in it, too. There's a Harley Quinn. But
a
I
Nightwing.
Guess the big thing with Gotham and Batman is that there is a new no vigilante policy, and there's an organization known as the Magistrate that is doing law enforcement, and it seems like they've killed Batman.
Huh. So is that, then who is Well, it looks like in this that Bruce Wayne is still alive.
So it looks like it does look like they killed Bruce Wayne and someone else is Batman or something like that.
Interesting.
They're doing some weird stuff there.
It's like a Batman Beyond kind of thing.
But their Batman has like he's got like no sleeves.
Yeah, that's cool. I really wish that they would stop doing the tactical gear look to him.
Yeah.
But, like, ultimately, I do think this Batman's a pretty excellent design.
It looks like there's two Batman books. There's okay. Future State Dark Detective, which is Bruce Wayne sporting a kind of more just geary type look.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that kind of was reminiscent of Year Zero, honestly, the Scott Snyder story.
I can see that.
Where it's like more tactical gear. And then there's Future State, the next Batman, which is actually a new Batman of some sort.
I see.
Yeah, so the next Batman design is designed by Nick Darrington, who is an Austinite, which looks, and it's a really cool design. And then, of course, the Dark Detective one is Dan Mora is an amazing designer, so.
Yeah.
It looks really cool.
So I guess that, like, also...
Yeah, I hadn't realized that there was a sort of, like, a sliding scale of a timeline. Like, a lot of these were happening at different points.
Right.
I thought it was all going to be sort of concurrently. That's interesting, because the things that they've done so far with, like, New 52 and, what was it, Future's End?
Yeah.
They were all sort of concurrent storylines, just the one big story. This one seems to be trying to say a little bit more. And I honestly think the people they've got, the creative talents that they've got for this are pretty exciting because it's a lot of new people.
Yeah.
And I would like new blood to be injected into DC because a lot of it is the same people doing the same things.
Yeah.
Also, I'm seeing like some designs done for different Wonder Woman characters by Jen Bartel and Joelle Jones.
Yeah.
And like they're some of my favorite artists who are working in the business, so I'm like really excited to see that.
Yeah, so one of the Wonder Women is actually the new Wonder Girl, and her name is Yara Flor, and she is the spawn of like Zeus and a Brazilian river god, I think.
Huh.
And she is one of the Wonder Women, and the other one is Nubia. And it says like she is in the distant future, and she's got Batman's utility belt and maybe a Green Lantern ring around her neck.
Oh, wait, no. I think that's... Wait.
That's the immortal Wonder Woman. That's Bartels.
Yeah, yeah, that's Jen Bartels. Sorry, I was
And then they're also
the
doing a thing
page.
Where Superman is like a gladiator on Warworld, and his son is actually Superman.
Yeah, so, like he did something unthinkable and gets kicked out of Earth, essentially.
Yeah.
Can you answer this for me? Because I can't quite tell the way that the color on the cover is. Is he wearing just briefs with, like, the S in the cloak, like, chained to his bare chest?
I don't think so. That'd be weird.
Yes,
I think... What?
It looks like because there's blood spatter, and I see like cuts in his skin, so which would mean that he is basically wearing a Zardoz outfit.
So,
I'm a big fan of naked bombs. Just throwing it out there.
So yeah, look, you're right. Wow, that is weird. Okay, so
I love it.
He has a chain. Oh, he's a Martian Manhunter style Superman
thing. Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
Basically, that is chained. The Superman symbol is chained to his body, and he's wearing like this weird kind of slave collar.
Also, he's got boots.
He does have boots. With ankle
chain
bracelet thing. Manacles? Are they
manacles.
Still called manacles when you put them on your feet?
Yeah. These are probably called space manacles.
Space manacles,
space manacles.
From
the design work on all of these is really
It's so
nice.
Good.
Yeah. John Timms, like I said, Dan Mora, Michael Janin, Joelle Jones.
They're also bringing in Jackson Hyde, the Aqualad from Young Justice, as the future Aquaman.
I think their design for Zatanna.
Zatanna is good. The design for Superwoman is really good.
God,
Marguerite Savage.
Superwoman design is so good.
I'm usually very particular with my Nightwing designs, and I'm still getting used to the chin strap.
Yeah.
But I like the design that Nicola Scott did. It feels very much in kind of with love towards the old design. But yeah, I'm curious. Red Hood is Red Hood.
I was going to say,
you can't really get better than that.
Orphan and Spoilers designs are, like, so good. Those are also done by Dan Mora.
Yep.
I like how colorful Spoiler is.
There's also a couple, like, Shiloh Norman's Mr. Miracle's in here.
Yep.
And, who else did I see?
Chloe Hamner designs for The Guardian.
The Guardian, yeah.
Which, I'm like, bring on The Guardian, that sounds cool.
So, yeah, and then the artwork in general looks really good on all of these.
Oh, so there's a in regular color version of that Superman costume. He is in fact not naked, sans.
Boo.
Yeah, don't like that. Get rid of it, DC. Make him naked.
Yeah, he should be wearing his Zardoz outfit.
And the Legion of Superheroes drawn by Riley Rosmo, I think, is a really cool choice. So I'm actually really excited for all these. I feel like I'm going to be sad when they're over in two or four issues, because some are bi-weekly and some are not. But I think this might be the breath of fresh air that I've wanted for DC to jump back in a little bit.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. And it is sort of it's a thing you can jump in, read, and then they're going to go back to sort of launching the books again, we know, in probably in March.
And I would imagine, and there are still some odds and ends that are going to be coming out, like Batman, Catwoman, and things like that. Yeah. So this is not the only thing DC is going to be putting out.
It is most of it, though.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some Black Label books that are still going to be published.
And, right.
But I'm excited for this, because characters that I haven't seen in a little while are getting kind of major things, like Swamp Thing and Guardian.
I was
going to
say, is that a Swamp Thing design? Swamp he looks thing amazing.
Book, yeah.
Dang.
Also, yeah. Grifter's in there, which is weird.
Yeah, that is super weird.
Yeah, but Grifter's in the current Batman, so if he's tied
also,
to Gotham.
Red X, is that what that character's
Red
name
X
is?
Red X from Teen Titans.
Yeah, he's somehow being brought in.
Delightful. Very delightful.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see where they go with this, and if they pick up with if they continue like with them beyond these one shots and that kind of thing.
Honestly, I love a lot of these designs because they seem similar in, I don't want to say tone, but like spirit to the design for the Green Lantern over in Far Sector.
Oh yeah,
like it
has
a very shiny and sort of like future-y look to it.
And she's in the Justice League in this one.
Oh, she is.
Yeah, she's the Green Lantern.
That's awesome. I'm really stoked about that. I was so worried that after that book ended, that character was just gonna never show up again.
They clearly like that character
That's awesome.
It's mentioned here somewhere we saw that she is the Green Lantern in that Justice League.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah.
So yeah, this looks like it's going to be running from January 5th all the way through February 23rd. Except for one, the Superman versus Imperius Lex number 3, which hits the end of March, which is kind of strange, but sure. Hmm. I know we'll be ordering a bunch, but it would be super helpful if anybody, if you know you want some of these, to let us know so we can kind of order appropriately. But I'm excited.
Yeah, same.
All right, well, that's Future State. We're going to take a break for a second, then we're going to come back and talk about comics for the week. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, December 2nd. Guys, we're closing in on the end of the year here.
You know, but it's the start of December. There's plenty of time, lots of time for anybody who's buying presents and stuff.
Yep.
You've got all the time in the world. You know how right now, 2020, every month is like a year.
Yep.
So there's plenty of time to suffer.
I certainly feel like I've aged at least 5 years within this year.
I feel like that would be like the most morose Bond movie title, Plenty of Time to
Plenty
Suffer.
Plenty of Time to Suffer. So there's 3 weeks of comics left after this.
That's true. There'll be some exciting stuff.
Isn't there 4 weeks? Am I just making that up?
Is it a five-week month?
Is it a five-week month?
That's possible.
I thought it was, because I thought there was...
Last Ronin 2, I think, is coming up, right?
Last Ronin 2 should be next week, I think.
Yep.
I thought DC was sneaking in a final one.
People are going to, like, on December 25th, they're going to have access to Wonder Woman 84.
There's indeed 5 weeks this month.
Fool, Randy.
The fifth week is the 30th.
But this is a pretty good comic week. There's some stuff.
It's a lighter week than we've had, but there's some interesting, some promising new books.
Yeah.
So probably the big thing for us, I think, is King in Black.
Right. This is Marvel's... Is it a crossover event? I don't know how many crossovers there's going to be in this.
It's a crossover event.
This is actually bigger than Empire, because Empire got shrunk down.
Okay.
It's bigger than Ten of Swords.
But, and Ten of Swords probably had, like... I'm going to say maybe more clout or hype or whatever, but Donny Cates has made a big name for himself at Marvel lately. This is why we've had so many of y'all asking for Thor, looking for Venom, anything, Guardians of the Galaxy. Is that did he do that?
Yeah.
And even Silver Surfer Black, and all of them have been, he's been like leaving breadcrumbs and stuff and paving the way for the King in Black. A.K.A. the invasion of the Earth by the symbiote god Null.
Yep.
I guess it's the second time that Donny Cates has done kind of a crossover event. Because he did that at Marvel Knights.
Marvel Knights.
I liked Marvel Knights.
Yeah, Marvel Knights.
Yeah, it was like a little kind of pseudo-event.
That was just
like
a miniseries. It was like 5 issues.
But it was good.
It was. This is him taking on basically the entire Marvel Universe. Because he gets to play with all the toys.
Right. Yeah. This is the weird thing. When I was kind of making the sign for this and I was looking at the preview art, it showed Venom calling in the Avengers, and I'm like, this is weird.
It is weird. It is super weird.
He is spearheading the operation. It's like he is in the spot that Cap normally would be because he is the expert on symbiotes and has had dealings with it. If I'm not mistaken, the first story arc in the Venom comic from Donny Cates, which is, what, maybe 2 years old?
They're issue 30, so it's getting there. Yeah.
Three years old. Featured like this weird symbiote dragon as like one of the major threats in it, and it's like this just a terrifying monstrosity. Only that's like one of like thousands of them in the invasion.
There's an army of symbiote dragons.
Yeah,
I will say as issues go, this is a dark one.
It is. They are kind of like reminding you that they're like things are bad,
but it's in the metal kind of
it
fashion.
It is. It's kind of that. Sometimes hopeless is fun.
Yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed this. I thought, and I haven't been reading Venom, so I wasn't sure if I would get all of it, but I like...
All you need to know is Eddie Brock has a beard and a kid.
Yeah. I like them referencing the Moreland, like vault thing. That was a cool idea.
Yeah, that was, for people who don't remember, that was that Spider-Man vault thing that had... Was that also where, like...
Silk was stuck.
Silk was in there, yeah. That was like it's like from Spider-Man lore.
I mean, like the X-Men and Krakoa are mentioned in here.
The X-Men moment in this is one of my favorite Pony issue.
It's awesome. Yep.
It was a great little moment for X-Men.
And there's some core Avenger stuff, but there's also some like some B and C list heroes that you see because they have a kind of an interesting plan. That's like Tony Stark has an interesting sort of frontline plan to slow them down. But there's like just as a random example. That their first wave on the ground is like heroes who have electricity powers, since that's one of the vulnerabilities of symbiotes traditionally over the years.
Yeah,
fire and electricity.
Fire and electricity and Sonics, I think. The Hedgehog?
Yeah.
Audio Sonics. There is a sense that they, although they are like, had to put this together hastily, that they do have like a plan. It's just that Noel is a god. And he has it's such an overwhelming force that almost instantly they're like, oh, this is going bad.
How long
and that's the theme of the issue.
Yeah.
How long do you think it took Ryan Stegman to draw this?
I don't know. It's really beautiful.
This is probably the best. I mean, he's done some amazing work, but there's some great city shots here. There's like several double splash pages.
There's some big, neat reveals. Like the one that I'm pointing to that we're not going to say what it is because it's a spoiler. Like, is that something that's something that's been known? Or is this
no,
a reveal?
No, this was a reveal, and at least as far as I know, it was a reveal. But I know that the Avengers have been dealing with those kinds of threats like throughout Jason Aaron's runs.
Interesting.
So.
It's one of those things that once upon a time, if you had told me that you were going to do a Venom story with this kind of cosmic level of stuff, That seems just silly. Like, it's just goofy. He is a Spider-Man-level villain who, like, the Avengers could take out if they needed to.
Well, and Cates is making, like, callback to, like, Bendis's new Avengers run.
And weirdly, by the way, even though I am not a Bendis fan, that callback is a pretty decent one.
Yeah.
It was a smart one, and I kind of like how they turned it on its ear.
There's a weird connection to an issue of Daredevil that hits this week.
That's a real background shot, yeah.
That must have, was that just like changed up art or something?
I don't know. Or I like to think that Donny Cates is talking with a lot of the other writers.
Hopefully so.
Which I think would be cool. But also, Noel's a good villain. He is, like, super evil and just kind of like I don't give two shits about anybody.
Yeah, he's smarmy. Cap is at some point about to say Avengers Assemble, and he fucking interrupts him. And he's like, is that what you've got, the best you've got? And I think that was a little bit of a, I'm going to out Thanos from Donny Cates, but and I don't think, not in any sort of mean-spirited way, but more in the rivals metalhead kind of style.
I didn't think about it till this, but I'm going to make a prediction.
Yep.
I feel like Thanos is going to be the person that saves.
That's a crazy thing that they're going to have to call on him,
because Donny Cates also loves Thanos.
Also did write Thanos. That'd be fascinating. That'd be like the ultimate enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of story.
Yep.
Ryan, we will put you down. It's long odds, Nick, but it pays off 50-1
if
you're right.
There's a precedence
there. You get 50 symbiotes.
Yep.
If I had 50 symbiotes, a lot of things would happen.
Uh-oh. Toy Stores Beware. You're about to be wrecked.
I was thinking on more of a grander scale.
No, fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, let's do a little test run on them.
Sure.
But, yeah, although it's dark, it is kind of like a fun... Like I said, there's kind of an enjoyable quality to this dire state of things
it
here.
It also feels big.
Yeah.
It's not like a tiny event. There's like some huge things that happen in here, so...
Yep. And Storm got a cool bit in it with the X-Men stuff. I don't want to like say too much, but like... So this is something I always like is when it's not... when you know, like, if say you were doing a Thor book, you expect Thor and all of his buddies to shine. But if, like, Spider-Man or the X-Men were to show up, then you don't expect them to do too much more than filler work.
Yeah.
I like... But every once in a while, when the writer gives a spotlight to essentially a guest star, I really like it. It's charitable. It's cool. Storm is always cool. You don't want to punk her out. She does some badass stuff.
Yeah, no, punk Storm is the best Storm.
Yeah, that's ironic.
Yeah. I also love that Cates does the... And I'm sure he's done it throughout his entire Venom run, but the talking back and forth between Eddie Brock and the symbiote...
You know, I miss it when it's not there.
I do too.
I realize that to me, it's like the heart of it is his weird relationship with Venom.
Do you hear symbiote. It in Tom Hardy voice now?
Pretty much.
Yeah, I do too, actually. I can't help
it. Eddie. It's so fun. It made me want to watch it again. But yeah, that's I think that's a as crossovers go, that's a very legit kickoff.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
And there was one tie-in this week, which is the Union, which was originally supposed to be a tie-in to Empire.
Right.
Oh, interesting.
But they've repurposed, and it does look like they've made it fit, and they're dealing with stuff.
Essentially, it's a new UK team, but the dealing with basically it was going to be they were previously going to be dealing with the crisis that was the Kree-Skrull conflict. Now they're dealing with the Null invasion.
The team on the front of it, I don't really recognize beyond Union Jack, but this is written by Paul Grist, who
he's British. Give him a hand.
He's British. He wrote Jack Staff.
Jack Staff, which it's like if people don't know this, that was like an indie incarnation of a. Captain Britain type hero.
It was Union Jack.
Or Union Jack.
100% Union Jack.
And it was like literally based on the fact that he had like a pitch that was like it was like his indie version in a weird way that kind of similarly to how
Jeff Lemire
did his indie versions thinking, oh, I'm never going to get to work with Marvel and DC. So I better do my indie versions of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's his pedigree.
Notice that the art is that Andrea DeVito doing the artwork inside of? Nice.
Yeah. Always like his stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't get around to reading this one, but this is it's essentially a new UK team forming up.
Yeah, it's a solid superhero opener, and I actually really like Union Jack, and I like Paul Grist as a writer, so that was fun. Also, Marvel has a one-shot this week, the Fantastic Four
Road Trip, which is, in fact, a road trip story with, I'm going to say, like, some sort of horror elements. Even the cover... is weird, like it shows like the thing with big chunks knocked out of his armor where you can like see his muscle tissue underneath. Invisible Girl has parts of her body going invisible that make it look like, you know, like you can see her brain and stuff. It is creepy looking. Johnny looks like he's burning to death.
It reminds me a little of that Morrison, was it?
Yeah,
four?
Fantastic Four, one, two, three, four.
Yeah.
Yep. And like I think this is one of those things just to pick up like on a whim. It's got really cool art from Felipe Andrade, is that how you say it?
Yep, and it's written by Christopher Cantwell, who's doing Iron Man right now.
Oh, that's interesting. People have been kind of discovering that Iron Man run, I think. That's been interesting to watch. But yeah, if you want to see like some of these sort of, I think both the normal kind of like enjoyable family banter of the FF, combined going kind of like down a slightly horror road, I'd say it's worth checking out. You know, and there is, by the way, there's precedent for that. I remember when I was like a kid reading that Fantastic Four issue that John Byrne did, where he goes to the town where the Skrulls that were turned into cows by Reed, back in like Fantastic Four number 3 or whatever, that the milk from them had like slowly saturated the town with this like shape changing evil gene, like the Thing or something, and like the whole town was like this creepy evil town of quasi Skrulls. I guess it was their homage to the Innsmouth. What is that story called? Shadow over Innsmouth.
Yeah, Shadow over Innsmouth.
What else we got?
Marvel also has MODOK Head Games number 1.
Yes.
Finally, Big Head MODOK gets a comic. Even as he has an animated series on the way. It's from the same creators.
Yeah, Patton Oswalt and Jordan Bloom, who, do we know if he's related to Blumhouse? Like, Jason Blum?
Is it spelled that way?
Yeah.
I imagine...
Then yes, he is.
Yes, from
that's
now
Jason's
on, he is.
Jason's brother.
Okay.
Maybe, or maybe not at all.
But Nick, you and I enjoyed this.
This could have gone wrong in a lot of ways.
For sure.
They could have gone too jokey. They could have just played MODOK for laughs.
And it does have some lightness to it, right? I didn't read it yet, but there is some humor.
It does, but it also adds a bit of character to MODOK that is needed without taking away that he's made for killing. He is, like, killing people left
It's right
and
there
right.
in the name.
It's
mental right organism designed only for killing.
There's something, they do a little bit of this, there's some humor in the surreality of AIM, like this big giant man is, like, one of the guys there. There are other scientists, this crazy psychopath named Monica Rampicini, who I was glad to see that.
Yeah, and I hadn't seen her in a while. That's awesome.
She was introduced in that Scorpion miniseries.
Yep. Wow, that was a little ways back.
She's become a member of, like, she's in the Avengers game, I think.
But
they're, and that kind of thing.
Now AIM is, like, run by a council of people.
Yeah, they have, like,
she's one of them,
directors.
And there's, like, a head AIM guy. And it opens with MODOK and Monica Rampicini on, like, a mission to steal stuff, and basically, it seems MODOK has, like, something has happened and he's misfiring, essentially. And it's very fun. I don't know how else to put it.
That's the thing. It's fun, but it's not goofy. I think that we were worried it was going to be this sort of goof-off thing, making fun of MODOK being a giant head and all that stuff. And they are having fun with it, but it's pretty straight. Like, he is having memories of a family he never had.
Hmm.
And there's definitely it sort of puts him at odds with AIM. Seems like he seems distracted, and maybe he's going to go find this family.
Well, and he's talking about how many times he's been reborn and sort of recreated.
Right,
and
which is true. That's Marvel, just the Marvel history revisiting him again and again.
Like, all of those maybe past lives are sort of catching up with him a little bit, which is kind of an interesting idea that I had never considered.
Yeah.
But of course, then things...
Is this a miniseries?
Yeah.
Yes, I think four issues maybe.
I don't want to say too much more because it's all sort of the delivery and the payoff. The cliffhanger is fun.
That's cool.
It's just a really good book. I think people should definitely try it out. And now I'm even more looking forward to the Hulu show than I was.
Me too. DC has a couple of big books this week. Justice League Endless Winter, which starts a new crossover.
That's co-written by Andy Lanning, who is the most people will know as the longtime writing collaborator with Dan Abnett. Who, like, they basically did the modern Guardians of the Galaxy. Like, the version that made its way to the screen, he conceptualized that.
Right.
And he also did Annihilation with him. So this is, like, a big story where the Justice League kind of get involved with something that is going to, like, lead to a frozen over Earth. Kind of one of those apocalyptic Day After Tomorrow environmental disaster.
It looks like Stagg Industries accidentally drills too deep and releases, like, a frost giant god or something.
Yeah,
like
he is, like, some sort of otherworldly being. Oh, and that's the other thing. It's like, there's ties to something in DC's past that had characters like Hippolyta, so Wonder Woman's immortal mom. The Viking Prince, yeah. I think, basically, I was wondering if we're going to get a two-tiered story the way It was, like Stephen King's It, mm-hmm. where you have, like, you see this guy faced off with, like, in, you know, essentially medieval times, and also in the present, but, you know, there was also a little bit shades of Final Night because of that had a frozen earth kind of theme to
right.
it. So, but yeah, if you're looking for sort of a DC eventy or kind of a survivalist DC miniseries, I'd say check that out.
And then there's Batman Catwoman, the long-awaited Tom King Clayman?
Yes, it's Clayman doing the art. This is sort of a continuation of not really the end of his story. It's more of a...
Batman run that was years and years long.
But there was a story that he did with Lee Weeks, I believe it was Lee Weeks, sort of in the middle of his run that showed a kind of a relationship,
forward?
A flash-forward between Bruce Wayne and Selina, and Bruce, like, dies of cancer, and mm-hmm. sort of about what Selina does afterwards. And this is sort of back into that timeline, jumping back and forth.
It's using the, what is it, the DC Black logo? What do they call that?
DC Black Label.
Black Label, yeah. Which means, I guess, that they can maybe, I don't know if that just is suggesting this isn't all definitively in continuity.
Yeah, this is sort of like...
But it also means that they can push stuff a little bit like they did with the popular Three Jokers.
Yep. This is also bringing in... it's right there on the cover.
I think we could say it.
The Phantasm.
Yeah.
Which is...
From Batman Mask of the Phantasm, yeah. And not too many other places. Like
right. Has she ever been in the comics?
I feel like she was in once.
Yeah, somewhere. I feel like they cannot resist doing that. And I think she did show at some point, but it was like, you know, kind of... It didn't take, I guess I'd say.
Yeah.
But yeah, like anybody who's seen Mask of the Phantasm, one of the great Batman movies. Some people like it's their favorite Batman movie because it's the only one that really reflects the comics.
Yeah.
But yeah, that character and her past with Bruce Wayne plays a role in this.
Yep. And it's really just about the relationship between Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle. At its core, it's the romance. And
I think I saw that what's-his-name, that Tom King said he wanted this to be his Dark Knight. Like, suggesting not, like, I think, like, literally recreating it, but, like, something that would be, like, his legacy work that he'd maybe be remembered for. It does glimpse lots of future glimpses of Batman.
Yeah.
So, but it's also showing sort of past and present and interweaving them. But it may be, like, become, you know, I think it, basically if he has his way, he wants it to become a sort of definitive take on their relationship, or maybe a final word on it.
Yeah. Like all of Tom King's work, it's a little, not highbrow, but it's definitely kind of a more elevated.
Let's say ambitious.
Ambitious, be nice. There we go, that's nice.
Snooty. No,
just kidding. An ambitious attempt at a story.
He thinks he's better than me. Is that what it is?
It is, no. That's what it is.
He's right.
Are Toms better than Daves?
No. Please, don't even.
The legions of Toms?
You can ask our customer Tom Reedy. He's a lowlife. I wish Tom listened to this because I know he would take that well.
What about Tom Hanks?
Lowlife. You remember he was one of the first people who got COVID. He probably started it.
What if Tom Hanks is not Tom Hanks and is in fact Stephen Pumpkins? Or
Stephen S. Pumpkins.
Stephen S. Pumpkins, and he's only masquerading as Tom Hanks.
That was a rare case where the mask slipped.
What about Tom Sawyer?
The Rush song.
Yes.
The Rush song. We're a little off topic here, and I want to bring it back home to Batman Catwoman for the sake. Because, yeah, I think people are going to want to check this out.
Oh, I imagine Tom King will mention Rush in his comics.
Clayman is also a super good artist.
He was the really nice.
I didn't like their previous project. What was it? Heroes in Crisis?
Yeah.
But, like, I never faulted Clayman's art.
Let me be clear here. You didn't like it, but did you not read every issue of that book? Or was that Nick?
I did not read every issue.
Okay, I thought you read all the way through it.
I skimmed for atrocities.
Okay, all right.
I read the first three, and then I read the final three, but I hate read them.
But here's the thing is, like, I think that there was, like, I remember you and Anna reading it, and there was lots of good stuff along the way.
Yeah.
Basically, I don't usually plug into Tom King. Most of our readership, I think, does, though, or at least there's a big contingent of followers. And, I think they're going to kind of know whether they want to check this out. But because it's such a broad topic of Batman and Catwoman, and it is kind of standalone, you don't have to have read his run or anything like that. I think a lot of people are going to want to check it out.
But I think if you have read his run, this is a definite win for you, because his Batman stuff is his best. I mean, I like Mr. Miracle and what it's doing.
Really, you think so?
But Batman is where he kind of created his
best he seems
work.
To have like kind of fallen in love with it in his way, you know. To the point where I think that sometimes people thought that those sort of flash forwards and things with Catwoman and stuff were like overindulgent, but like it felt like what he wanted to say about as a creator was, and like I noticed this like for sure in Mr. Miracle, he has thoughts on couples, and they're like deeper thoughts than usually, like, oh, I'd like to see them together, or it'll be more dramatic if they have a fight. He's really thought about this in some depth, and I think anybody who's especially been like married or long-term relationships is probably going to find stuff in there where you're like, oh, this guy knows what he's talking about.
The big book for me this week, Overwatch Tracer London Calling. This is Mariko Tamaki writing, Babs Tarr doing art, and it is the first full... They've done short stories that they do digitally, then they got collected in hardcovers.
For Overwatch.
This is the first four-issue miniseries of Overwatch, and it focuses on Tracer, their lead character, who is a... She's a British girl. She has time travel-y powers. She has these two energy blasters. She can have super speed. She can sort of rewind time a little bit.
She's kind of a peppy hero.
Yeah, yep.
And somewhat notable, at least as far as the increasing tide of diverse voices. She's gay.
Yep.
She's got a live-in girlfriend, I think. Or I don't know if they're married.
I don't think so. I think it's girlfriend.
It's sin.
Come on, Nate.
Get married, you sinners. Just kidding. I'm kidding.
Oh my God.
No, they're delightful. I read this and I don't know anything about Overwatch other than like I'm on the periphery. I do know a bit from hearing y'all.
Sorry, I tried to drag into Overwatch and it failed.
It didn't take. It's just that game was just too fast paced. I'm just like, what? How do I shoot? And then I'm like, I'm dead. but I always like the backstory and characters.
Yeah, the characters of Overwatch are really, really good. Like, that's what drew me in the first place was...
Well, they have great character design, just visually, all of them look amazing. And then they have cool little fun backstories and hooks.
Yeah.
Didn't they do those shorts?
They do those shorts, which, by the way, there is a hardcover this week, the cinematic art of Overwatch.
Yep.
Which ties into all the shorts and that kind of stuff. A little art book about all the cinematics and that kind of
like, did we get that?
We got it, yeah.
Oh, cool.
Wish they hadn't stopped doing the shorts, though.
I do, too. I guess we're done with those.
I guess.
Well, here's the thing. Overwatch 2 is coming.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
And I bet that when that happens, we'll start getting more shorts and stuff. But anyway, this is basically Tracer winds up working with... One of the things in Overwatch is that the Omnix, these sort of robots... There's like an Omnic revolution.
Yeah.
And then there was a pushback. And so now in England, where she is based, the Omnics are sort of driven underground. All humans hate them. They're sort of the mutants. They're hated and feared.
Right. Just to double check, she's flying solo in this because Overwatch is disbanded?
Overwatch was shut down. Yeah. She's not actually supposed to be active, but she is.
Is that like something that happened in the game?
Yep.
Or is this like...
That's the central thing of the game, is that Overwatch got shut down because there was property damage or whatever.
Right,
all the superhero things.
Okay.
So basically, she winds up helping out this Omnic who's stealing... to get power cells for their underground operations.
I really like their interactions because there was
they
like
bond over music,
more flavor. Yeah, they bond over kind of like British kind of like punk music.
She meets a couple of punk rocker Omnics, which is really cool.
Yeah,
it's very cool. There's some fun action, and Babstar's art is great.
You know, so here's as an outsider looking in, the only thing I didn't like about it. Which really, like, I think you can presume that anybody reading this is, like, an Overwatch player.
You're like, why so many robots?
No, my thing is, like, I would have liked some little overview of what her powers exactly were.
That's
like,
true.
I kind of know them. I know she moves fast, but I wasn't sure about the time travel thing. I wasn't sure, like, why the laser pistols and stuff, and, like, if she was part of some sort of military thing. All I would have liked was maybe, like, either somebody, like, looking at, like, a monitor or something that had her powers on it, or maybe commenting on it as a little bit of...
Exposition.
But it was certainly, I even as a kind of very passing fan, I knew enough to figure it out.
You should have played the game.
Yeah, why don't you play the game, Dave?
I played the game a little, determined it super sucked, and moved on.
I'm sure the millions and millions of players agree with you.
They, you know what, there's millions and millions of Michael Bay fans, and they're probably the exact same people playing Overwatch.
So there's one last thing. Aftershock has a comic called Knock 'Em Dead. This is a very strange book about it, like a stand-up comedian that seems to be, like there's a thing at the end about him dying and coming back. But like most of this is just about a struggling stand-up comedian. And the thing that really drew me to it is the art is gorgeous. Like it is, it's a Matteo Monaco and Matt Miller of coloring. But check out that art. That is beautiful.
It looks like Francesco Francavilla and Sean Phillips. Or no, wait, no.
Who's Stuart Eminem, Sean Murphy.
Yeah, Sean Murphy is actually who I was trying to think
of. But it's really pretty.
If you don't know all those names, they're all talented artists who kind of work in a sort of like an inky, realistic style, kind of have some grit to their artwork, but also some really strong realism.
Yeah.
That's interestingly weird.
The other thing for me, of course, this week, a couple big ones that I really liked. Savage Avengers is really good. It does feature, this is a minor spoiler, but it does feature Wolverine feeding someone into a thresher, a la Fargo.
Yeah.
Nice.
So that's a thing that happens.
Finally.
And then Thor continues the story of like Don Blake gone bad, which I don't know that I like it, but it's being done really well.
That's what I was kind of expecting might happen. And, of course, I don't even know, like, how it is that Don Blake is a separate person or what exactly led to that. But that sounds interesting enough. I'll I'll be catching up on that at some point.
And then there's
I got a quick jump back.
Yeah.
Who is this on the Savage Avengers in the, with the hood? Is that Zartan?
He's a crazy cult leader guy who's like near immortal. That's why you got to feed him into a thresher to beat him.
Okay. He's got those cool like Egyptian sword scythe things. Yeah. They're cool looking.
Yeah, he's cool and goth cultist guy. And then there is Marvel Snapshots. I've been really enjoying these one-shots that are sort of Kurt Busiek's Astro City but in the Marvel Universe. This one is written by Saladin Ahmed, art by Ryan Kelly, which I forget how... Ryan Kelly's art is great in this.
Oh, man, Ryan Kelly. I haven't seen work from him in a while, but he's always been...
He does sort of an inky style, too, but this actually looks straightforward.
You're right. It's a little different from what I would expect from him, but it's good.
Basically, he's doing a thing. This is set during Civil War. The point of view character is like this old, pudgy, divorced dad S.H.I.E.L.D. agent who joined up to help defeat superheroes, but then sort of finds himself... There's these teenagers who don't really... Like, his power was to be a helper. He helped around his neighborhood with his little elemental powers, and then S.H.I.E.L.D. like brings him in with too much force, and he's starting to question whether or not S.H.I.E.L.D. is on the right side of things.
Okay.
It is definitely some nods to sort of what was going on with the Muslim ban and the border and some of the stuff that was going on under George W. Bush's watch.
Right.
It all kind
somebody of, doing the getting that one of those. Am I the baddie?
It's a good metaphor, and it's a good story, and I wound up really liking it. As with all these Marvel snapshots, they've been really good.
Yeah, you know, I need to read all of them. The handful of ones I've read have been really good. You know, of course, I love Astro City to pieces. Yeah. So, you know, when you do it right, when you actually have somebody who's a writer who can do a sort of thoughtful story from like a perspective outside superheroes, I really like that.
And they're doing a hardcover of them, and I'm definitely going to pick that up. So,
okay,
Nick, anything else on your stack?
Yes, of course.
X books.
Yes, welcome to Nick's Mutant Corner.
We call it Nick's Exposition.
There you go. But yeah, no,
Nick's Exhibition.
Ten of Swords is over, so now comes the fallout.
So now all X-Men comics are done.
No
more swords.
No, it just means they're going to add more now because they're going to launch a few more in January.
More swords.
More swords.
Tell us about the fallout. Is there in fact fallout from those events?
There is actually. It's some interesting fallout because the first book is Hellions, which in Ten of Swords, the entire Hellion squad was killed by Mr. Sinister, their leader.
My bad.
Does that mean that, like, I actually don't know. Do the Hellions include anybody who I would know?
Havoc, Quanon, Nanny, and Orphan Maker.
All right, but Havoc and Quanon, a.k.a. Psylocke's other half, are pretty notable characters. Death isn't so permanent for the X-Men.
No, they can get resurrected.
I was like, that's crazy. They're not really dead.
However, Wild Child, Quanon, and Havoc.
Wait, they got killed by Sassy Sinister?
They got killed by Sassy Sinister.
Man, I can't.
He's sassy and also, like, very lethal.
Right. I don't know how I'm going to wrap my head around this without knowing any of these details, but I'm like, that sounds like... I know that everybody got amnesty, but I think they would be like, oh, you killed some heroes, now you don't have amnesty anymore. But there's probably something I don't know about this.
Here's the thing, though. They only come back with the memories of the last time they were... basically, backed up. That Professor Xavier's Cerebro Helmet backed everyone up.
Does he not do that very
He does regularly? It often, but not, like, to the
Is
minute.
It as often as we back up our own computer here at work?
No, definitely better than that.
I don't know what you're talking about. We've had a perfectly good backup.
He only backs up, like, every once in a while, not to the minute of their death. So
they
know,
like...
they died. They know they've come back. They don't remember how exactly they died.
Does anybody else know?
Yeah, just Sinister.
Oh, that's an interesting story. Okay.
Yeah.
I like that as a premise. That's
but
good.
But some of them, the ones that have come back...
It'd be funny if he was all like, hi. Hey,
I mean, you're not far off from what he does. This is Zeb Wells doing a pretty, like, over-the-top Sinister.
Yeah, yeah.
But some of the people who died that died in a certain area have come back kind of... more feral. Feral. And
something weird.
They're
happened.
Like edgier.
Yeah.
Like Wild Child is like
it's
not
like they
as
got
crazy,
a dose of the
but
90s.
He is like more like mean. and Nanny and Orphan Maker, I never thought anybody would do a good story with them, but they're becoming good characters, which is just bizarre.
Well, that seems like sort of like what this run in general has been doing, is trying to like sometimes take weird characters and stuff and find a direction or a life
form.
You don't
find much weirder than Danny and Orphan Maker.
Also,
there's only gold balls.
This is not a spoiler, but Mr. Sinister has his own jet with his own AI named Clive.
Okay. That fits Sassy Sinister.
Is it called The Sin Jet?
No, but it definitely should be. And then the other book, X Factor, which actually has not been involved in any of the Ten of Swords.
They took a break. They hate swords.
They took a break. They don't like swords.
Oh, just to double check, X Factor are the people who, like, oversee people who are resurrected. Correct. And, like, confirm, oh, yeah, definitely died. Let's not rebirth somebody who's already around.
This is a team that is now run by Aurora and North Star.
Interesting.
And it opened with Aurora's death. And subsequent rebirth.
Right. I know there was, like, a mystery involving that, and that sort of set things
in motion. It's moved to Mojoverse at times, and it opens with Mojoverse and Adam X the Extreme.
This is strange. Is this a book where someone's just like, I dare you to write this?
You know, I like the idea of taking North Star and Aurora and giving them a starring role. That, yeah. Because so often those kind of characters are rather haphazardly or surface written, I guess I'd say.
I mean, it's a very bizarre team. It, those two plus Polaris, Deken, Rachel Gray.
And the X books are using every part of the Buffalo, aren't they?
No, completely. Yeah. They are not wasting anything.
Yeah, they've got enough books to, like, yeah, everybody's in this.
And one of, oh man, I forget his name, the really smart, is it Prodigy?
Prodigy.
Yeah, and Prodigy, he's part of it as well.
Wow.
It's interesting, and they're actually building up to Ken's backstory. Then he's got a romantic relationship with Aurora, which is weird, but I kind of like it.
Nick, let me ask you an important question.
Yeah.
Where's Dupe in all this?
Dupe showed up in X of Swords at one point. Nice. As a big team shot, he was in there in the fight.
I got the impression that Aurora likes to date bad boys. I know she dated the feral... Walter Langowski, a.k.a. Sasquatch.
But Langowski's a good boy. He's like a football player.
He's a jock D-bag.
He's a jock guy.
Now he's part of the green.
Yeah, but like, I think... I get the impression that broadly that she doesn't make great dating choices. No, he was probably a rare exception.
They haven't outright say that.
Yeah. she's a beauty with issues. Sadly, somewhat common theme in the real world.
And finally, issue number 4 of Black Widow, which is Kelly Thompson, is her story about trying to take Black Widow off the board by giving her a family, and how that goes really, really wrong. And this is some of the best action I've seen with Black Widow in a while. Doesn't rival, like, when Chris Samnee was drawing action sequences, but Elena Casagrande's artwork, I'm trying to find, like, when she's flipping over balconies and taking out Hydra guards.
That looks really good. Reminds me, I'm only looking at this from afar, but it reminds me a little bit of and is it David Aja was doing Iron Fist?
Yeah, it's a good comparison. But it also includes, like, Hawkeye and Winter Soldier and all, and makes out that Black Widow is one of the most cunning, most ruthless characters in the Marvel Universe, and I kind of like that.
Kind of elevates her a little bit. That's cool.
Yeah.
All right. That's Comics of the Week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about some movies and some TV. Okay, so I have been watching over on Disney Plus. There is a series, which is actually a series of, like, 8 documentary films that they sort of put together. They're all separate documentary films. They made them over a course of different times. And it is called Under the Banner of 616, which is the Marvel Universe.
Yep.
And each of these is really interesting standalone. I watched all 8. I really enjoyed them. I think all of them are worth watching for different reasons. But basically, it runs the gamut from the first one that is about Japanese Spider-Man.
That is such a weirdly specific thing to start with. And the famous live-action Japanese Spider-Man, I guess, was also a manga.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story.
And the last one...
Oh, yeah, but by the way, for anybody who doesn't know it, like, this was, like, Spider-Man who, like, had, like vehicles and stuff like that, and giant transformers.
They get into why he has a transforming robot.
Yeah, it is a crazy different from regular Spider-Man or American Spider-Man. I imagine that sounds like a fun thing to check out.
And the last one is about... Marvel has a plot program called Marvel Spotlight, where they produce plays for high schools, for high school students to do. And it's basically goes to this high school, and I think they're in New York, New Jersey, about the auditions, the casting, the rehearsals, and the actual the play. One is Miss Marvel, and one is Squirrel Girl, and it's basically the origin of each one of them.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So it's like one of the kids getting cast, like, I think gets cast as MODOK. There's the girl gets cast as Squirrel Girl. In the Ms. Marvel one, there's a girl who gets cast as Kamala Khan. Bruno, Mike, Bruno's girlfriend is in it.
Nice.
You know, years ago, I remember hearing about Marvel doing this kind of student theatrical tie-in stuff, but I'd kind of forgotten about it.
So it's really interesting, and it also gets in, like, they talk to the girl who's been playing Ms. Marvel, who has real anxiety about getting off book and being nervous about it, and one of the show the kids sort of struggling with this, and they show the teacher. It's really fascinating. It's like just a good feel good story, but it's also like that is cool. Someone is like, they do little costumes for Squirrel Girl and Miss Marvel, and it's really fun. This Japanese Spider-Man one, they have the actor who played Japanese Spider-Man.
Yeah,
they have the actress who played his sort of like his Mary Jane character. They show they talk to the creator, and he talks about how he pitched it. It's this older guy who basically went to Japan, and they were like, he's like, the Sentai stuff is huge over here. We don't have anything.
That's
like
all the
that.
Power Rangers yeah. stuff.
And then they went back to Stan Lee, and he was like, great!
Yeah, so they basically, he pitched this, and he's like, let's make a Spider-Man for Japan. And they're like, in Japan, all these things were like, well, we do this to sell toys, so it's like, he has to have a robot and a vehicle and all this stuff. And his origin is like, A spider alien. He gets blood yeah. from a spider alien, and that's
and it's like a stunt bike like, guy, right?
Yeah, he's like a stunt bike guy.
No Peter Parker, no nope. down on his luck photographer, yep. no Aunt May.
And they talk about they show all the different stuff. They show the stunts, which are crazy because the guy was like, it was just a guy who was like actually on a rope, like on heights and stuff. They were talking about how crazy and dangerous it was. They talk about his bad guys that are really interesting, but they also talk about. They talk about the pitch meeting, because the guy's there, and he's like, yeah, I came back, and I showed them this, I showed the Marvel people this pilot they made, and they're like, what the hell did you just do? And he's like, this is great, I'm going to lose my job, I'm not going to be able to stay in Japan. And he said, like, Stan, like, stood up and clapped, and he's like, this is perfect. And they also, at some point, they were like, let's just keep this in Japan. Yep. Let's not show this anywhere outside.
Yeah.
So,
like, by and large, I think it was kind of, a lost like a lot of people don't know that there was a Japanese Spider-Man.
Right.
Comic nerds. Like if you're a little bit in the know about Marvel, you might have seen some glimpses of it over the years. And now the comics sometimes acknowledge it with the Spider-Verse yeah. stuff yeah. has yeah. brought him in. But yeah, that's a deep cut. That's pretty cool though.
And then the second episode is the Women of Marvel. So they yeah. talk to everyone from. The woman who is like the one of the main like traffic coordinators early yeah. on, but they also talk to the people in the 80s who I knew, Joe Duffy, Ann Nesenti,
yeah.
Louise Simonson.
They were like, I guess, kind of breaking the glass ceiling. They were really some of the big forerunners.
Yep. And they focus on Santa Amanat, who is the mm-hmm. editor, who's like a major editor of Marvel now.
Yeah.
But she's one of the people who. The Miss Marvel is clearly based on her. Like, they show her and her parents.
Her show is really interesting.
Her parents and her parents are clearly based. Like, that's what Miss Marvel's based on, as much as G. Willow Wilson.
I liked hearing her that she didn't really know what Marvel was, and they were yeah. wanting her to bring in as an editor. And she was like, "I don't know if I can do this. I don't feel like I'm comfortable." And they were like, "No, we want you in this because you bring a different." Yeah. voice to it. I was like, this is really great.
And they talked to Kelly Sue DeConnick yep. about the creation of Captain Marvel became like the first major female lead character for yep. them.
You know, unless you're generally a kind of a deep cuts comic reader, like who's interested in that side, or you do a lot of conventions before COVID, a lot of times you don't like get to see these people at all. Yeah. Like, you know, you yeah. might not know who any editors were, or you might not see, certainly women writers of the 80s are not going to get much of a voice like online. So that's really cool that they,
it's really
them.
Good. It's really inspiring. It's really sort of emotionally affecting, I think, yeah. too.
It was also cool to hear like Ann Nesenti and Louise Simonson talk about sort of Marvel bullpen in that era.
Yeah.
And kind of how it was, everyone was kind of ragging on everyone. I believe was it Ann Nesenti or was it Louise Simonson who had their image drawn?
Ann Nesenti was the editor working with Barry Windsor Smith. And she got a pic. Somebody drew a picture of her as a doormat.
Yes.
Because the notion was that Barry Windsor Smith, she would just let him walk all over him. And Louise Simonson's like, you got work out of Barry Smith. You did your job. Like, yeah. like, it's impossible to get work out of Barry Smith.
Yeah, he's like a notoriously mercurial artist.
Yeah.
And they, that's what I was going to ask. Is like, is there, like, that sounds like a little bit of a warts and all thing. I know that these are probably meant to be a little bit, like, they're meant to hype up Marvel and stuff.
Yeah, Disney, for sure. But Marvel,
like, do they show a little bit of, like, the difficulties and stuff of these people?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it is all sort of promotional. But, like, it's weird how the tones are so different, because there's the one that's like Paul. There's one that's like about Spanish artists.
Yeah.
So he talked to Natasha Bustos, who designed Moon Girl, and Javier Garon, who's doing Miles Morales.
Yeah.
And they show them and their like what their life is like and their drawing, and that's really interesting.
I haven't seen that one. That's
episode three. Episode four. It's maybe my second favorite. I think the high school play one is my favorite, but this is Paul Scheer, mm-hmm. who you would know from a variety of things. He's a comedian.
He's
actor.
On a bunch of television shows.
He's a podcast.
He was on he does like two or three like huge podcasts.
He was on The League. He did some voice work for various things. Basically, it's him pitching to DC. He goes to Disney Plus, and he's pitching a Marvel character. They're like, bring us a character that you want to do for Disney Plus. And it is sort of parody of documentary almost. Mm-hmm. And he settles in on, so he goes and talks to Donny Cates, Jerry Duggan, and Richard Hudlin about sort of their favorite weird characters. Donny Cates pulls up Typeface, who's a guy I'd forgotten.
Whoa.
Is a bad guy. I don't even remember where he's from. I know I've seen him, I just don't remember where he's from. And among the people that get talked about, US-1 is also talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Brute Force, a four-issue miniseries by Simon Furman that was basically their attempt to design a toy line.
Simon Furman, the Transformers.
Yes. Along the lines of Transformers and G.I. Joe, they're like, well, instead of taking a toy line and making a comic, let's make a comic that we can make a toy line out of. And it's basically animals that transform into vehicles that fight. And it was a four-issue miniseries. It's this weird thing, lost to history thing. Paul Scheer basically is like, I'm going to do this. He's going to go to the animation studio to redesign it.
Uh-huh.
Talks to his famous friends about voicing them and shows them the new designs. And it's like John Hamm, Jack McBrayer, Rachel Bloom.
Who's the guy who voices King Shark?
Oh, yeah, and Ron Funches. So it's all these guys sort of looking at these things, sort of just playing it straight but also making fun of it.
Yeah, that's
interesting. And it's basically as if he is trying to make an animated series of Brute Force.
That's crazy.
There's even a, like, one-minute video of it.
Wow.
It's hilarious and weird.
I want him to bring back Krishtar.
Then there was the episode that was, like, taken out of my brain, which is all about action figures, and basically the people who work for Marvel Legends and toy photography.
And they go through the history of, like, the toy biz stuff.
Yep,
and
toy biz.
When they first started making the X-Men figures.
The Secret Wars figures that they originated everything.
The creation of Marvel Legends.
Yep.
There's a toy photographer that they talk to.
Yeah.
Then there's the cosplay episode.
The cosplay episode's really good.
And they tell great stories with this. Like, there's the guy who dressed up as Captain America. And his wife, for the first time, when at New York Comic Con, is going to be Peggy Carter.
Uh-huh.
She's real nervous about it, and he's really excited to have her dressing up. And then they talk to this girl who, like, this woman who works with dogs, and she's sort of got some, like, depression issues, mm-hmm. and cosplay is, like, her outlet. There's a non-binary person who does a Doctor Strange. It was, like, the first place that they sort of explore their gender a little bit.
Interesting, yeah, yeah.
And then there's a woman who does a Cable outfit.
There's a woman who does a killer. That's the one who does one.
Oh, that's okay.
One
that's
the dogs. She does a killer Cable outfit with her like boyfriend who does Cyclops.
Yeah.
And they also there's a girl who does a Shuri.
Uh huh.
And judges a costume contest and like this is all like pre-COVID, so it's like they show the Comic-Con.
Sure.
They show all these costumes. They show how they do it. They show why they do it, and it's really really good and informative. I loved every single one of these. They're all really good.
And they're all, like, directed by talented people. I know, like, Allison Brie.
Allison Brie and Gillian Jacobs from Community.
Yeah.
You know, y'all talking about these, though, it's really the first I've heard of it. Is Disney Plus pushing this? You know, are people talking about it and I'm just missing it? Or is it kind of a little under the radar?
I have a handful of friends who've talked about it, but mostly it's, like, Yehudi, who works for Disney.
Yeah.
And
it seems like something that a lot of people would like, and it seems like, as pleasantly, is not just like, hey, we're going to talk about our latest summer event to hype it, or we're just going to talk about an artist that, like, you know, like Todd McFarlane, or is it just somebody who's, like, already famous and well-known and has videos?
Even there one that they do that, there's a one that's Dan Slott talking about Iron Man 2020, is a fun look behind the scenes of how he works. They show artist Pete Woods, who apparently lives in an RV now,
uh-huh.
and just goes and draws on the beach. He's like, you can draw anywhere. They show him drawing. They talk about him working Marvel style, which nobody else works Marvel style anymore.
That's interesting.
And then they talk to Christos Gage, who is co-writer, and it's all about sort of him launching this book. But it's also talking about Dan Slott as a writer, and it's really fascinating. All of these were really good. They're not just propaganda pieces. They're actually really good documentaries. I would recommend them to everyone. I was so glad I watched this.
Yeah.
I'll definitely check it out.
Alright, so let's take a break, and then we're going to bring in Anna to talk samurai with Dave. This would usually be the point in the show, for the rest of December at least, where we do Nick's Holiday Corner.
And we're going to do it next week. He was ready.
Yeah, Nick.
But we're going to hold off because we need to catch up on the... You, the viewer, can do this too and catch up and be ready for
us. So Nick and Dave both watched Happiest Season, isn't that what it's called?
AKA the lesbian rom-com holiday movie with big star power, Kristen Stewart. And Mackenzie Davis and...
the guy from
Aubrey Plaza.
Yeah.
And Aubrey Plaza. I have not a chance to watch it yet, and I do want to watch it, so I don't want to get spoiled, so we're waiting until next week to talk about it.
Yep. I think it was spoiler warning. Nick and I kind of generally liked it. So if you got Hulu, give it a look.
Also,
we'll talk about it in more detail later.
Also, we're probably going to talk about Christmas Chronicles 2 next week.
Yeah.
Also, quite possibly, depending on how much I watch, we might talk about that FX Guy Pearce Christmas Carol thing.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I set so somebody on that, and it was it's so dark that I was like, I almost regret recommending it because I'm like, I don't think people know what they're getting into. This is a version of the Christmas Carol that like drops the F-bomb probably in the first 5 minutes, and it's hardcore.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
It's brutal, and it's literally just called a Christmas Carol, but it's from the BBC, and it's like, I think it was like, I think 3 1-hour episodes made into like, they just have it packaged as a 3-hour movie now. But it's... I recommend it for people who kind of think Scrooge got off too easy for his lifetime of exploitation.
Yeah.
Because it does not let him off so easy. There's horror elements of it. And yet, it does still, I think, contain the basic heartwarming or at least like a humanistic vibe of the original Christmas Carol, but not but with a tougher edge to it for sure.
Dave, you know how me and many people rank like the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies?
Yeah.
And, like, the Star Wars movies.
Yes.
I think you need a definitive ranking of your Christmas Carol movies.
I could put together, like, 5 or 6 pretty easily.
I was going to say. All right. But instead of the Holiday Corner...
Samurai time.
We brought Anna back.
Hi.
Because it's time for Dave's Samurai Corner.
Gong hit.
You need, like, a theme song? I feel like it should be hip-hop. Like, there's, like, a record scratch.
That'd be awesome. Yeah.
I'm sure the RZA's going to samurai.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm
saying. We'll get some samurai shampoo stuff or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I don't know what, like, kind of put samurai back on my radar. Well, I know
Ghost of Tsushima.
Tsushima some months ago. And then recently, it tumbled for me into wanting to play the Legend of the Five Rings starter board game, which I'm going to try and rope y'all into.
I'm already in.
And
let's do it right now, Dave.
I mean, that's the thing, is like, it teaches you, the first game is you are taught the rules, so like you can like literally jump into this one.
Yeah.
But then there's I've been finally like, I've seen some Kurosawa movies. I've seen like maybe 3 or so over the years, several of his Shakespeare adaptations, and I saw Seven Samurai like 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't seen it in ages, so I was like, it's time for a revisit of the guy who's like pretty much known as the father of samurai cinema.
Yeah.
And you have you've seen a number of his movies.
Yeah, I have like a very strong fondness for samurai stuff, almost to the point that I feel like I need to have a duel with Dave to take the samurai corner.
I feel like your knowledge is deeper than mine, but I can be the young upstart who gets killed.
All right, Dave, time to die.
Because listen, like young upstarts, like in samurai movies, like you are. You are generally going to get schooled.
Yeah, absolutely.
So do we want to talk, like, I'm going to talk about two in particular, two of the big classics, what about this, Seven Samurai, and then we'll do Yojimbo?
Yeah, so it's, full disclosure, it's been, like, years since I've seen Seven Samurai, but I did revisit Yojimbo, like, a week or so ago, about when you did.
And Seven Samurai is a story that people, even if you haven't seen it, you've seen it.
You've absolutely seen it.
Because it's the story, it's been remade several times, it was also remade as The Magnificent Seven, but you probably saw it, like, on an episode of The Mandalorian in the first season that was straight-up tribute to it. The one with where they defend the village from the Scout Walker.
Yep.
Basically, anytime you have a village of poor folks, like farmers and peasants and stuff like that.
And a bunch of badasses who teach them how to fight.
Yeah, because they're going to get shredded by bandits or whatever. And so some badasses come in to like teach them how to fight and also to put themselves at risk and like kind of push it to the edge.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's the story of Seven Samurai. It literally begins with a guy who's overhearing some bandits at the beginning. He's just, like, in the bushes when they're riding by. And he hears them saying, hey, as soon as they're done pulling their crops or whatever, or harvesting the crops.
Yeah.
Pulling them. I don't know about farming, yo.
That sounds like a really dirty euphemism.
Go, give it a crop yank.
Quit yanking your crops over there.
Man. He knows that basically, like, within, like, a month or two, the bandits will come, and they are just going to decimate the village.
Yeah.
And so they go on a search. A few of them go into, like, a nearby, like, town to, like, try and start recruiting some samurai. And I guess they're pretty much all looking for, I think, Ronin, more or less.
Yeah, they're looking for samurai who don't have masters, because yep. those are the only people who would work for food, which is the only thing that they can pay them.
Right. And it's like, the recruitment itself is not easy, but they... The guy they bring on first is a very charismatic lead
yeah.
who's, like, an older samurai...
He's the veteran, right?
He is, yeah. And he has this great look. I don't know, like, what to compare him to, but, like, sort of like one of those Max von Sydow kind of actors, mm-hmm. where he's got, like, this, or Christopher Lee. He's got a vibe to him that's, like, energetic, but he's got kind of like he's kind of like a monk almost, and he feels like it because they actually shave his head early on. There's somebody in the village, like a bandit or something, who's holding someone hostage, mm-hmm. and he wants to. This is something you don't think about, like samurai. It's been like an undercover samurai thing.
Yeah,
he's like, I'm going to pretend to be a monk and get in and, like, say, like, oh, I'm just there to, like, you know, bring you some food or whatever. You know, in a lot of ways, this is something that we've seen in hostage situation in police movies and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he goes in there and he takes out the dude. And then the whole rest of the movie, he's continually, like, rubbing his shaved head, just like you do anytime you ever get anything shaved. You're just, like, endlessly amused by it. And he has that sort of zen, you know, like, he is a tough sensei type guy, but also smiles a lot, and he's kind of warm. And he begins helping them at that point, once he gets on board. And they bring in this collection that includes, like... Oh God, I love it. It's like the second or third guy they recruit, he asks the... Like, he brings in somebody next who's, like another good, like, kind of tough old... Like, he's a real serious guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then they bring in somebody else later on who's, like, a... He says, how is he? And he's like... As a sword fighter, just okay. Like, they just straight up say he's just okay, but he's, like, he's going to be a guy who, like, is going to pick our spirits up.
Yeah.
He's, like, worth more than he looks like.
The funny one. Is he the one who's, like, cutting wood?
I think so, yeah. He's okay. The funny one. And then there's Toshiro Mifune, you know, the muse of the director Kurosawa.
Yeah, like, everything.
And in my memory in this, like, I thought he was, like, one of the big serious samurai, but instead, he is this lout...
Yeah.
He's, like, loud-mouthed, like, drunk constantly. Like, his first introduction, he's just totally plastered.
Yeah, I mean, he's basically abandoned himself.
Right. And they, like, laugh at him, but they realize... But, like, he follows them, almost like a puppy.
Yeah.
Even though he's also kind of a hard-ass, too.
Mm-hmm.
But he clearly wants to belong to something. And you'll find out over the course of the story that the reason he's, like, you know, has maybe sympathy to this cause... And they all have their different reasons for joining, is because he was once a farmer, or like he's the son of peasants.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very dramatic scene where he actually is angry at the farmers, who are mostly in this pretty oppressed and kind of, sometimes kind of weirdly cowardly, like they're almost their own sort of sad character. But he is talking about how they're like duplicitous and they're going to hide stuff that they could pay you with and they're going to hide food. And he's like, but then he blows up at the samurai and he's like, you know what made him that way? It's you. He's like, people like you did it.
Mm-hmm.
And you've brought war and, you know, you've killed them and you've forced them into this. So, but this is a long movie.
Oh, it's extraordinarily long. Almost all of his movies are.
You know, my buddy Fathery, who I podcast Star Trek stuff with, he loves this movie. And he is like, every time I watch it, he's like, I don't want it to end. And if you're feeling that way, it's a perfect movie because you're just you're just spending so much time with these samurai.
Yeah.
Do you have like favorite parts? And before we get to like the defense of the village,
I mean, I hate to say it, but it's been so long that I can't quite pick out like
individual, like, scenes and stuff.
Yeah, just based on your memory, or if any there's anything...
But I have, like, a pretty intense fondness for Toshirô Mifune's character, Kikucho.
Yeah.
Just because he's exactly the kind of character that I love to play in role-playing games, which is to say that he doesn't feel like he belongs there, but he's trying real hard to.
Yeah.
And it's something that I find just incredibly endearing. Almost every time he's on screen, I remember thinking, like, this is the thing this is the thing that makes me like the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He's real magnetic, even though he's kind of a lout.
Yeah, like, he's a bit of a dick.
Yeah, he yells at the peasants when he's training them. Yeah. He likes to kind of prank people and stuff like that. But, and he's also, like, kind of, there's an interesting thing where he's clearly jealous of a lot of their roles, and there's some depth to him. So the interesting thing about the movie is, like, you will see lots of little sub-stories in there, almost like side quests. There's a very young samurai, like an untested kid, who falls in love with a girl. Mm-hmm. The local farmers are worried about the samurai running off with their women, because they're all kind of handsome warriors. And so they like literally isolate them and hide them in like a portion of the village so the samurai don't even know where they are.
Yeah.
But this guy finds his way to one, and so he's got like a little love story. There's there's one of the farmers. His wife was taken as like a concubine of the bandits, and he's like out for vengeance. And people don't know why he's so distraught. So there's just like all these little subplots and stories. Even though the main story is very simple, you know, you're going to get to see iconic samurais in the rain. Their defense of the village is actually, like, super realistic. It's almost a procedural.
Mm.
They do some things that don't even seem, like, necessarily, like, sporting. Like, they let one or two bandits get into the village, and then all the villagers with spears chase them around until they can spear them down. So there's, like, dozens of guys chasing these, but they're well-armed bandits.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a big price to be paid when all is said and done.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty much a quintessential samurai movie. You just might want to watch it in parts if you're not ready for 3.5 hours.
I was going to say,
Dave, are you still watching it right now as we speak?
Yes, it's on my phone. I just need to catch the last 10 minutes.
Yeah, I was going to say, focus is a rare commodity, I think, at the end of 2020, after we've all been beaten and battered. So, man.
I feel like we're the samurai at the end of Seven Samurai.
Yeah.
Too many dead ones, and everybody there is thoughtful and contemplative.
Yeah.
But hopefully we'll get to kill some bandits before it's done.
That's true.
So let's jump to the kind of more roguish movie, Yojimbo.
Definitely.
And Anna, tell me about the plot of Yojimbo.
Toshirô Mifune playing basically a wandering Ronin is a bodyguard. That's what Yojimbo means.
Yep.
And he ends up in a town that has like two warring factions.
Yeah, it's like two kind of
bandits, like or maybe they're like yakuza almost.
Yeah, they like run gambling dens and stuff like that, and prostitution. And there's like a kind of a complex backstory where one of them was like the son of the other guy, and it was like, or basically, like, he didn't hand off the business to his partner, he's handed off to his son, and that caused a split. But, like, really, all you need to know is that there's two rival crime factions in the town,
And he sort of ends up playing them off of one another,
right?
Until he's the only one left standing.
Yes, this is another one that's been remade as movies, including Last Man Standing,
also from Fistful of Dollars,
I believe so, You know what I noticed in these movies is there's not a whole lot of mention of, like, the normal samurai code of Bushido and honor and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, clearly some of them do, like that monk guy, or the guy who gets his head shaved in Seven Samurai, he's a very honorable dude and, you know, very classic samurai kind of personality.
You'll see,
but not all of them are.
You'll see more of that, like, as unspoken stuff. Like, I think that the sort of, like, oh, I can't do that, it's against my Bushido code type dialogue is, like, a very, like, expository thing that Western people who are unfamiliar with it need to throw into the dialogue.
Right, right.
But, like, in Throne of Blood, for example, you'll, like, watch the sort of, like, descent and backslide of a character who is very honorable and has, like, a very upright and rigid moral code. Mm-hmm. That's the Macbeth-esque
It's an adaptation,
one.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you definitely won't, like, hear it ever spoken in so ham-handed of a way or anything along those lines.
Real quick, something you mentioned. I do want to mention, the action in these movies is very cool, but it's kind of realistic.
Yeah.
I actually think the cooler action sequences are in Yojimbo.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But there is some cool, like, you know, that, you know, like, a samurai guy is, like, having like a sword in Seven Samurai. He's just having a sword fighting contest with wooden swords, mm-hmm. and the guy he like does a strike with another dude, and like it's kind of unclear as to who got the actual hit.
Yeah.
You know, they do like slow mo if it was sports, mm-hmm. but he's like, the samurai master dude is like, I won, and the other guy is like, no way. He's like, I won, and he's like, okay, whatever. This and the samurai guy's about to walk off, and the guy is like, oh, are you insulting me? And he's like, draws the sword, and he's like. And the samurai master guy's like, you cannot win this. And they do that thing where Kurosawa used early slow motion. These were 1950s movies. Mm. And the guy, like, races at him, and they go into slow-mo as he cuts him down.
Yeah.
And we talked about this, Anna, off mic a few days ago. It's like, there's no real blood in these. These are,
yeah,
like...
Yeah, they're very devoid of...
Yeah, somebody will swing a sword, and somebody will fall to the ground dead. But it's not like it's always... It still feels kind of gritty, though.
Yeah, I was gonna say, despite the fact that, like... People will hit each other with swords,
yeah.
As you're wont to do with swords, but, like, their clothes don't ever, like, shred, and blood doesn't go everywhere.
Right.
And even so, like, still the pacing and, like, movements of the people are very realistic.
Right. Yeah, and so, in Yojimbo, there's a scene in this that was lifted for Star Wars.
Yeah, in fact, there are a lot of scenes in Star Wars that were lifted for Kurosawa yeah. films, but...
The latest Mandalorian, which I know you haven't seen, yeah. but it has a scene that is the straight exact duplicate of the standoff at the end of Yojimbo.
Oh, okay.
One guy awesome. At one end of the street, and like a line of like 10 or 12 people at him.
Does he throw a vibro knife into someone's forearm to stop them from shooting?
To Star Wars' credit, and this is also why I would say to George Lucas's credit, he uses the inspiration but it doesn't follow the events. It was like, it was literally an homage shot.
Okay.
But then what happens afterwards, completely different.
Fair enough.
But, so yeah, this guy plays people against each other, and he is like, everybody is bidding for him because he is a badass. And in this, in this Star Wars scene, everybody remembers the scene in the cantina in A New Hope when Obi-Wan cuts down the guy who's like, oh, I've got the death sentence in 12 systems or whatever. Well, this is that scene. Mifune's character walks up to some guys, and he's literally just, he is actually starting a fight. Like, he wants to show off that he's a badass, and they start showing off their tattoos and talking about how they are, like, all the crimes they've committed, and he chops the arm off of one of the dudes, and then slices up two of the other ones.
Yeah.
And there's a running gag in it that, so this is, like, just straight up Obi-Wan chopping the arm off.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
There's a running gag that the only guy who's kind of potentially profit from this is the coffin maker, and he's as Mifune is walking away from this scene, he says he's got two more customers for you or whatever, and then he looks back at the guy with one arm clearly not going to make it, and he's like, better make it three. but the whole movie is the kind of fun watching him play them against each other.
Yeah.
Sometimes he's like skeevy. He's like,
oh, he totally is.
He is not like an honorable samurai.
He's definitely like a at any costs kind of guy.
Yeah, and he's enjoying like being fed, getting higher prices from one group and then the other group, endless kind of like manipulations. But as you get into like the latter half of the movie, you see he does have this bit of this heart of gold. Mm. And there's like somebody who's gonna like an innocent person who's been caught up in this, and he kind of can't help but help them.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it leads to a very cool showdown. There's also a scene where he gets the hell beaten out of him.
Oh yeah, and that and in the final showdown are some of the only like really notable standouts that I can think of where they have blood.
Right.
Like I think you mentioned this one when we talked off mic, but then as we watched the YouTube clip of the final showdown, I do remember that he's got like blood pouring out of his arm.
Right.
When he.
Yeah, I think they decided those were sort of notable enough. And again, this was the 1950s when blood didn't get shown in horror movies really either and stuff.
Yeah.
So showing it was like pretty notable.
Mm-hmm.
When he gets beat up in this, by the way, it's not like when people get beat up in Fast and Furious movies and they're on their feet 5 minutes later. He has to spend days in recovery. He's probably got bruised or broken ribs. He makes an escape from, like, their bad guy's hideout at some point, and he is crawling and, like, hiding in every shadow, and, like, it's stressful.
Yeah.
It's like a stealth game where you're super injured.
Yeah.
And then there's an amazing showdown at the end, which is, like, he gets to be a full-on badass.
Oh, it's totally... He takes on, like, straight-up 10 guys.
And one of the guys has a gun, which is, like, it's a big thing in those days.
I was gonna say, it's particularly notable because it's what gives him his power, because he is otherwise, like, kind of a doof.
Yeah.
But
he's kind of sly, too.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's fun to see in these movies. You know, you kind of think of samurais as being sometimes a little one note with their honorable streak. At least that's the Western view of it. And what I liked about Yojimbo was all the ups and downs of this duplicitous guy.
Yeah, and I mean, you can very clearly see, like, a lot of the parallels between Westerns and, like, samurai, especially Kurosawa's samurai stuff, when you watch these, because they are such a pretty tremendous, like, genre influence.
Yeah.
But, like, the way, like, a Clint Eastwood character behaves in a Western,
mm-hmm.
like, that is the kind of behavior you can generally expect from one of Kurosawa's samurai.
Totally.
Which is to say...
a huge crossover in Western and samurai. Yeah.
Oh, and just as an interesting point, although Yojimbo has been adapted, it itself was an adaptation of, I read this, a Dashiell Hammett, like, detective story.
Oh.
So that it was, like, I guess that Bruce Willis' Last Man Standing, that's a period piece, right?
Yeah.
Like in the 30s or something. That may be the closest to the original story, because I assume it was like rival mob gangs or something like that.
Hmm.
So yeah, it's just kind of fascinating bit of, you know, I mean, obviously Kurosawa was drawing from Shakespeare and stuff, so European influences, American influences. It's an interesting circle.
Hmm.
But it's Yojimbo is definitely the sort of more easily fun of the two, and I super recommend it. I was glad you recommended it to me, Anna.
Yeah.
And then I found out there's like a sequel with him playing the same character called Sanjuro.
Yeah.
And I haven't watched it yet, but it's
actually watched that either.
It's on the to-do list. Let's watch it and compare notes.
That's what we should do.
And then we can do a little follow-up mini Samurai Theater.
Yes, we can cut the Christmas corner in half
for another
Samurai
Yes. Anyway, do you have any other final thoughts or anything, Anna?
No, I just... I mean, one thing that I did want to specifically call back to was you had mentioned briefly that you were playing Ghosts of Tsushima.
Yes.
Which has its, like, Kurosawa mode where you can turn it into, like, the grainy old-style film.
Yeah, it's a black and white with grain texture or whatever. Yeah.
Similarly, I had also been playing the much more fantastical version of that sort of genre game, Neo, which is definitely more of a mythological look, but that was sort of what, like... launched me into my like sort of not necessarily obsession, but like my recent like want to dive.
Right. It like it re-kickstarted your samurai love.
Yeah, and like I picked up a subscription to the Criterion Collection because they have literally all of Kurosawa's films, even like some of his much much later ones that are in full color and like modern.
I want to see Ron the like I think his last movie, which was itself an adaptation of King Lear.
Yeah. But, like, I watched Throne of Blood, and I hadn't watched Sanjuro, but clearly I'm going to have to watch that.
Hell yeah.
But, yeah, I do recommend that for your next one you watch Throne of Blood.
That sounds good.
It's extremely long and very depressing, but good luck.
You know what? The samurai stories tend to have this that streak in them, and I like it.
So, diverting over from Samurai Corner, there's one other movie that I think both you guys have watched recently, or it does have samurai in it, sort of. And that is The Dead Don't Die.
Oh, yeah.
So this is Jim Jarmusch's zombie movie that he made last year.
Yeah. Randy, you haven't seen it?
I saw it in the theater.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Now, here's the thing. I've talked to all of you. I believe we all have mixed feelings on this movie.
I wanted to love it, and instead I left, and the best thing I can say is that I think my reaction was, huh. That was a thing.
For those who don't know, it's a very dry, indie... zombie comedy. It uses some zombie tropes, but it's like, and let's just real quick say who's in it. Bill Murray.
Yep.
Oh, there are so
Adam
many
Driver.
People in it.
Adam Driver. Tilda Swinton.
Yeah.
Some other big
crap. A ton of people. I'll look it up.
Danny Glover.
And Danny Glover.
Buscemi.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right.
But it's like very dry humor. You know, I know when the trailer came out, I saw some of my sort of indie nerd movie friends who were like, oh, this looks so great. I got to see Jim Jarmusch do this thing. And I saw somebody else, I think it was Yehudi, by the way, Randy, kind of waggishly say, it's like, I mean, I think he was like, it looks okay, but he's like, it feels like this guy just thought he was the first person to ever think you could do zombie comedy.
Yeah.
Okay, so Chloe Sevigny.
Yep.
Tom Waits. Rosie Perez.
Man.
Playing Posey Juarez. Carol Kane.
There's also...
And perhaps most importantly, the RZA.
Yeah.
As being the UPS driver.
The
WPS driver.
Also,
that actually is my favorite part of the entire movie.
Iggy Pop is in it, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know what my favorite part of the movie was? Sturgill Simpson, the great country singer,
does
a song for it. At one point, they're driving, and it's playing on the radio, and somebody's like, that's a good song. And he's like, yeah, it's the theme song to the movie. Yeah. They just say it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some weird fourth wall. Also,
yeah, just so odd.
It's weird enough. Tilda Swinton plays the, like, coroner in town.
I am so in love with her.
And then all of a sudden, it turns out that she's a Scottish alien.
Yeah.
Samurai.
Well, you know, the deal is, she's kicking ass, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
But, like,
a
UFO comes for her.
Yeah, she just gets... I mean, it is so difficult to describe, but I do think it's particularly funny to note because Jarmusch, I think, has a fondness for samurai stuff, and as does the RZA, and they've worked together on stuff in the past. So, like, the, like, really, like, lovingly crafted, like, shots where she's, like, in front of her shrine and, like, trying out her sword, like, techniques and stuff. Super fun, and, like, they're setting her up to be this, like, badass who might save the day, but, of course, you know what happens to badasses in horror movies. They die to show everybody what the stakes are. But instead
of taken back up by their aliens,
and this was like
she calls an alien spaceship and just
it was like
leaves.
She was too cool and had to ascend to the heavens instead of
she's like I'm out of
she's
here.
Just like I'm leaving now.
By the way, while Posey Juarez is one name, do you know what Tilda Swinton's character name is?
What is her name?
Zelda Winston.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's got to be like very similar.
Yeah, that's hysterical. The movie, as I recall, and like I think I told you all this. When I was watching it, I changed my mind several times during the actual watch. I'm like, oh, I kind of like this movie. I like it. And then I was like, man, this movie is lame. I don't like it. It's it's too dry or, you know, whatever. And then I guess I ended up liking it.
Yeah,
but
I
it's
think
a weird
I'm flick. Very mixed on it.
I can't say I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm sort of, like, right on the line between can't say I liked it and there are enough parts that I liked it that it outweighs the things that I didn't like.
Uh-huh.
But it was so fucking depressing.
Now, you saw it more recently than I did.
I saw it last night.
am I correct? There is a sense of kind of humanity having brought this on themselves.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, like, Tom Waits is, like, closing narration as he watches everybody just get murdered.
Yeah.
Where he's basically like, well, now everybody's dead. But then again, they already were dead the whole time because they just sit here and they just go about their business, like, trying to buy the next new thing or whatever. And it's like, I mean, one, not the first movie to make zombies as a satire for consumerism.
Right. Arguably the most famous movie of all time, zombie movie, Dawn of the Dead. Kick that off.
Where it takes place in a mall.
Yep.
But I think that this is even more heavy-handed than that. which I didn't like. But I did like Tilda Swinton, the Scottish alien samurai.
Yeah, I think there's basically, it's probably worth people trying out, but no, it's going to be a weird movie.
It's real fucking weird.
You're probably not going to, like, laugh hysterically, but you may chuckle some.
I did, however, like...
It's a chucklesome movie.
It's a chucklesome movie, yeah.
Bark ugly laughter. When, like, every time Steve Buscemi was on screen, he's such a gross, nasty man.
It's such a weird thing to put to use, this amazing cast.
Oh, so odd.
Right, like, you feel like it could have been, like, a potentially a great movie, but he clearly wasn't trying for, like, a Shaun of the Dead or a Zombieland.
Yeah.
Jim Jarmusch, I think, is gonna Jim Jarmusch.
Yeah, he's gonna Jarmusch, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it's basically, if someone were to ask me, like, should I watch this, I'd be like, no, but you'll probably get some enjoyment if you watch it.
Yeah,
but
this definitely.
Is the fact that you've asked the question means you should probably go ahead and watch it.
Yeah.
Just make up your mind for yourself.
Also,
I had a friend, by the way, who was a big martial artist who watched it the other day. He really liked it. I was sort of surprised. It was, in some ways, one of the most enthusiastic responses I've seen to him. And he is not like an indie movie nerd. He's like a kind of martial artsy nerd.
Dave, when you say big martial artist, do you mean that he's big into the martial arts, or is he like 9 feet tall and a martial artist?
All of the above.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Similarly, one of the things that did make me like it more was when they're like in the cop car at the very end, and like Bill Murray's character is like, you keep saying that it's gonna be bad, like it's gonna turn out poorly or whatever.
Yeah.
What the fuck do you mean by that? And Adam Driver's like, yeah, well, I read the script.
Yeah.
And Bill Murray's like, what do you mean? I only got a script with my scenes in it. And Adam Driver's like, yeah, no, Jim gave me the whole script to read the whole thing, so I knew it was going to be bad. And Bill Murray's like, that fucking asshole. I've done so much for him, and he gave me pieces of a script.
Here's the other thing. I don't know if there was a script. I feel like this could all have been improvised.
I think that's possible. that, you know, he's one of those directors who basically anybody, people are going to want to work with, because it is like, there's a certain kind of, like, it's dry, but there's a craft to it that Jarmusch has that makes it kind of very watchable in its way.
Yeah.
And so I imagine people, I know people who are always probably going to want to work with him, and yeah, I can picture them to, like, you know, but it's interesting to think of, like, it may be actually a tightly written script.
Yeah.
That's the other weird possibility.
Bill Murray, in the later days of his career, works with, like, he does the arty things. He does, like, Sofia Coppola, Wes Anderson, Jim Jarmusch.
Yeah.
And then Zombieland and Garfield.
Well, you gotta do something to make the money so that you can do the weird indie stuff, right?
I think he made the money when he did Ghostbusters.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, look.
A lot of that went to cocaine.
I'm not commenting on his spending habits or his cocaine addiction, alleged.
Yeah, actually, I don't even know anything about Bill Murray's.
We just assume.
But I assume he was alive in the 80s, probably so. But I know that talking about it has made me want to see it again. And you said, what'd you watch it on?
HBO Max.
HBO Max. So I've got that right now. I will check it out again.
All right. That will close us out for the week. This has been an interesting mix of stuff.
Yes, it's been a weird one.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. And until that time,
Yo, Joe.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.